Thanks. Well, thanks for inviting me and listening to me. So I'm not going to tell you about the MFT, but I'm going to tell you about the models that should be looked at with the MFT. I'm going to tell you what's wrong with the conventional Hubbard model and how to fix it. And it's a concept that I don't think has been discussed before, which I call dynamic Hubbard models. And I'm going to discuss a few models with auxiliary bosons and also with only electronic degree of freedoms. And this physics that's missing in the Hubbard model leads to a new view of electronic energy bands, quite generally, and to the realization that holes are not like electrons. And that leads to a new route to superconductivity, which I call superconductivity from undressing, which I hope you will find interesting because it's qualitatively different from the conventional ways. And I will, but I may not get to it. Well, I will get to it, but for people that have their, I mean, high TC is very controversial, so I don't want people not to listen to this talk because they think in a particular way about high TC. So I will talk about possible relation with Cooper's phenomenology and superconducting materials, but please don't get hung up on that, and let's just think about the fundamental stuff. So electrons in solids interact with ions with interaction strength 14.4 electron volt angstrom, and they also interact between themselves with the same interaction strength. Right? And so, of course, band theory assumes that electrons don't interact or that they interact weakly, and we are all here because that's not adequate in many cases. And so the simplest model that one uses to go beyond band theory is a Hubbard model to deal with electronic interactions leading to electronic correlation. I want to tell you that the Hubbard model is not just not enough, that it needs to be supplemented. I want to tell you it's fundamentally flawed, that in a sense it already threw away the baby with the water. In a sense, I would say it's like this. Can you teach a child to read Shakespeare before learning the alphabet? The Hubbard model is trying to represent something fairly complicated, but it's missing a very basic feature of electrons. And so at the risk of overemphasizing obvious things, let me tell you what it is. For a single atom, in the Hubbard model, we have three states, the zero, the up, and the up down, with energies zero and U, or we can have some level energy, but let's put that to zero. When we create an electron in an empty orbital in the Hubbard model, we get the singly occupied orbital, and when we create a hole or destroy an electron in the W occupied orbital, we get the singly occupied orbital. Well, that's where the Hubbard model goes wrong. And it goes wrong because this W occupied state is not a single slater determinant that is obtained from the vacuum by creating two electrons in single particle state. And of course, everybody knows that, but we don't use that fact. So let me go back and just emphasize one more time. Let's go back to basic quantum mechanics. There's wave functions and there's energies and there's Schrodinger equation, and if up down pays an interaction energy U, it means that those electrons are interacting. Otherwise we would set U equal to zero. But if the electrons are interacting, it means that the wave function, first of all, is not the product of the same wave function that each electron would have when it was by itself. And second, it's not describable by a single Slater determinant, but by a sum of Slater determinants. Two electrons interacting are not a single Slater determinant. That's the essence. That's where electronic correlation starts. Okay? And the Hubbard model includes the effect of electron-electron interaction in the energy by U, but not in the wave function. And that, I would claim, is internally inconsistent.
Is it possible to derive something more general than the Hubbard model, starting from more first principles?
Yeah. Well, let me discuss. Because then, of course, one can say, well, we extend the Hubbard model, put in more orbitals, and we get it all back. But the point is to isolate what is essential physics. Okay, that's what I'm trying to do. So the real atom. We have a nucleus, H plus, and we have H with one electron. That's a Hubbard state with one electron. Well, the state with two electrons is not, as I said, the product of the same wave function as with one electron, because electrons interact. The wave function for two electrons is rigorously a sum over Slater determinants, which we can expand in single particle states, for example. So it is a sum. And as long as the spacing between the lowest state and the next state is not infinity, and I call that spacing epsilon, you need to have that. Okay? Only when epsilon is infinity, I could say, well, that's the end of the story. So, more typically, this epsilon is going to be in between T and U. The spacing between energy levels is not going to be bigger than U. So to throw it away, we cannot even justify it by a kind of renormalization approach where we say we throw away high energy degrees of freedom. Yes?
What if I said that the single electron state you have there and an object with a more complicated core is just as raw, has just the same problems you're telling me I'll have if I put two in, because it in fact doesn't look like that. It's some.
Well, for hydrogen, what I'm saying is rigorously true. For a bigger atom, what you are saying is rigorously true. I still want to argue that this essential physics is important for any energy band. And the reason is that in a given energy band, the electrons or the holes can correlate themselves to do something about this physics, while they cannot do absolutely nothing with what's below them. Okay, so that's just a background that will dress the single electron state, but that doesn't matter.
Try to not just put stuff down below them. Why can't I argue that if you're getting more dotted lines around that H, let's have it be copper.
Yes.
That I could put that hole that seems to be missing in that orbit, I could put it down below, put an electron above, just as you're doing here, and then I'd say the Hubbard model also has trouble in that direction, and maybe.
Yes.
Simple way. Let these be effective parameters and say it's got trouble both ways, and I throw them both.
It doesn't have trouble both ways. The reason it doesn't have trouble both ways is because it's quantitatively very different to have trouble in the same band than to have trouble with something below, and it's not the same because the orbitals in atoms get closer in energy as you go up in electron number, and so the effect is just qualitatively different. And anyway, if worse comes to worse, that's just to hydrogen. In hydrogen, we have to agree that there is a qualitative difference. And the other thing about this qualitative difference is, if you think about it, the U in an orbital goes as Z, the ionic charge, and the epsilon, the spacing between energy levels, as Z squared. So the importance of this effect is going to go down when the ionic charge is large, because this epsilon is going to be large. And the importance of this effect is going to be enhanced when Z, the ionic charge, is small. Okay.
Well, like you said, it seems to me when the atom gets more complex, then your effect.
Okay.
More important.
Well, okay. Let me put it this way. I'm not really talking about complexity of the atom or how many core orbitals. What I'm saying is the following: compare the situation with hydrogen, and with helium plus plus, helium plus, and helium zero. So exactly the same electronic configuration where I change the nuclear charge. What I'm saying is, because the spacing of energy levels in helium is much bigger, this physics is much less important. And so it's the ionic, net ionic charge what I'm talking about. And
it should be the valency basis,
yeah.
Not really the atomic, not the nuclear charge. The number of valence electrons.
No, not the number of valence. I'm saying that
frozen core concept.
The physics I'm talking about is going to be much more important in oxygen minus minus than in carbon zero. That's not what I meant. In oxygen minus minus than in neon, let's say. Because they have the same electronic configuration, but oxygen minus minus has less ionic attraction. Okay?
Right. I think your effect is also very important in the F shell, because the epsilon, the distance between
yes.
the levels is very small.
Absolutely. That's also true.
And
yeah.
The D and the F yeah. are very close.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, when you go up in the periodic table, this effect should become more important because of the angular momentum degeneracy and so on. Absolutely. So for hydrogen, it's the worst case from that point of view. I agree. All right. Just to make it a little more concrete, again, just for hydrogen, you can of course quantify all this and see different wave functions for two electrons. The simplest is a Hartree wave function. Then you can construct one with just two atomic orbitals, which is called the Eckert wave function. This goes back like 50 years, or the Hilleros wave function, or more than 50 years, 80 years. But the point is that, and then you can use this to extract the physics I'm talking about. In any of these realizations, the point is the states of the two electrons is different from putting the two electrons in the same orbital where the single electron is, and then you can ask, how does that change things? So qualitatively, how does it change things? And again, let's focus on hydrogen so we don't get confused. Up is the ground state of a singularly occupied orbital, and up n are the excited states. Up down, as we said, is a linear combination of Slater determinants, not a single one. So when I create an electron in the vacuum, I get up. And when I destroy an electron, I create a hole in the up down, I get a sum of terms. First one I call S times up, the ground state of the singularly occupied, and then I have other terms which are never zero. Okay, so the spectral function, the atomic spectral function for an electron, defined this way, is going to be just a single delta function of weight one, and that's what I'm going to call the quasi-particle weight. And for a hole, I have to do the same linear combination, but then when I destroy a hole here, I get more than one term, and because of that, the spectral function has more than one term. And for hydrogen, this is rigorously true. For atoms that have some core configuration, this is not going to be a delta function. I still claim that the z of the hole is going to be smaller than the z of the electron, because all this physics of the band we are talking about is there, okay? And if you want, the hole also will interact with whatever is below, but this intraband physics forces you to have these different spectral functions. So in a many-body system, these are numbers for these wave functions, just ignore them. Qualitatively, what I'm saying is the following. This atomic physics, then we go to a many-body spectral function, which has a quasi-particle peak and an incoherent part, and we can try and get some idea of the weight of the quasi-particle from this atomic physics consideration. And for example, for these atomic wave functions, we can calculate this z for the atom, and what we see, say, in the simplest Hartree calculation, it goes down as the charge of the ion goes down, as I told you before. Yes?
I think I missed the point.
Okay.
Can you explain again why the whole spectral function has all these peaks?
Yeah. Let me go back. What I said is because the state for the single electron is just one state, and the state for the two electrons is a linear combination. When I create the electron, I get a single state. When I create the hole, I get a linear combination of states.
But why do you start from the W occupied state to compute your spectral function?
Well, I'm computing spectral functions as a function of, say, the position of the Fermi level in the band. So when I'm at the top of the band and I have the band full, I create a single hole, I'm going to get something like...
So you are starting from the ground state, which is not singularly occupied.
Yeah. Well, I'm starting... I want then to map this to a band and say if I'm at the bottom of the band and I create an electron, that's a spectral function.
That's not the hydrogen atom.
Right? Yeah, this is a hydrogen atom. This is a spectral function.
But the hydrogen atom has one electron in the ground state.
Okay. Yeah, well, this is a hydrogen ion if you want.
Okay.
All right. So this quantitatively, as I said, the z will decrease as the ionic charge decreases, and when the z decreases, the incoherent part, of course, increases. And so just again, qualitatively, when you think about conduction in a solid, how does a single hole conduct? Well, every time the electron hops, this is correlation that it has to adjust in the orbitals, the electron just goes through. Okay, so you can see, one more time, that the conduction of the hole is a complicated process, and it goes slowly, in this computer at least. Conduction of the electron goes fast. So that's what I say electron-hole asymmetry. Yes?
Can I interrupt again? Suppose these were coppers just for a minute, and we had some oxygen between, around.
I don't want to get into high TC. I don't want to get into high TC. Could you give me any other example, and we'll discuss it? Any other atom? Any other atom? Any other atom? any other atom? Okay. What's the question? Sorry.
The question is, there's a background response of something that seems to be missing down in the lower model. But if that something lay at a sufficiently high energy, I would think we would arguably integrate it out, and the effect you're talking
yeah.
about is there.
Right.
It would affect the overall ability to transfer somehow.
Yeah, there is other things in a solid. There is dressing of other things, phonons, all kinds of things, and I am emphasizing here the dressing that's different for electrons and for holes. Now, other dressings will be perhaps the same for electrons and for holes, interaction with other electronic excitations or phonons or whatever. But in a given single band, there is this different physics. And so in a given single band, and after all solids have bands, and I'm trying to make the point that in a band, there is always going to be this physics that, if you want, gets added to any other physics, that tells you that there is going to be a large Z at the bottom of the band and a small Z at the top of the band. Correspondingly, incoherent conduction and large effective mass at the top of the band and small effective mass and coherent conduction at the bottom of the band. And let me do it one more time. So qualitatively, I claim that when you integrate all these other effects out, there is when you look at an energy band, you should think of it as a quasi-particle weight that is different at the bottom and at the top. And at the top, when I create a hole in the full band, the spectral function will look like that, or at least more like that, and the quasi-particle weight is less than it is at the bottom of the band. And so you can represent this physics by introducing quasi-particle operators. And in a very simple way, if I define a relation between my bare electron operator and my intra-band quasi-particle operator this way, where this is the occupation of the site, and then this just reflects this atomic physics I'm talking about. When the occupation is zero, the electron is the same as a quasi-electron. When the occupation is one, C is S times C tilde. And so this S is just this atomic parameter I was computing. And so when we write down a Hubbard model, what I'm saying is we are thinking about a model that has these operators, and we have thrown away the physics I'm telling you about because you are restricting yourself to a single band. You should write down a Hubbard model with these operators, and you're going to get new physics, okay? And electrons and holes are just languages. In a hole representation, the same transformation looks like this. So these are hole operators now, and so when n is zero, there is no hole at the side, then there is this large normalization, this S multiplying the quasi-particle operator, and then this parameter Y, which I call upsilon, which I claim is more important than the Hubbard U, is a key parameter. So it's 1 over S minus 1. When this S is small, what it does is it gives a large dressing, because the quasi-particle weight is S squared, large dressing to the hole at the top of the band, and this Y describes the undressing as you go down in the band and you increase the occupation. So just in a mean field, if you look at these things as a function of n, then the z as a function of n looks like this if we talk in electron language. So it's 1 for n equal to 0 and s squared for n equal to 2, and in whole language the same, of course. And correspondingly, the hopping, or the inverse effective mass, is just the bare hopping times this z, and so it increases as you come down in the band.
How is S related to the original spectrum, say, of
OK, S, and I'm going to come back to that. But S, basically, in the simple Hartree picture, S is the overlap of the expanded orbital with the small orbital. That's what S is. OK? But I'll say that more times than you want to hear it. Yes?
It has some energy denominator.
No.
Separate the levels.
No, it's just an overlap matrix element. It has no energy denominators. I'll come back to that, and then we can discuss it later.
But let me make sure I understand the main point. You start from the atom. You choose hydrogen, and then you show that for hydrogen, empty, single occupied, and double occupied are terribly different.
Okay.
I think that's completely clear.
Okay.
It's clear it's more complex when you go to higher occupation.
Okay.
But now let's say I do some other material, uranium or
plutonium. That, yeah. Okay.
I look at states n minus 1 and n and n plus 1. Those are the equivalent things that we're interested in.
Okay.
It's not obvious to me that the one with n minus 1 electrons is going to be simpler than the one with n plus 1 electrons. It may depend on the material. So the effect that you're talking about is
okay.
Physical and which is not obvious, is why always the whole is broken.
Well, we need to discuss that, and I can't claim I understand uranium in any way, but I do think that this is physics that has to do with energy bands, period. Uranium, no matter how complicated its orbitals are, forms energy bands that have a bottom and have a top, and that's universal. And the physics I'm talking about, I think, which in hydrogen is easy to understand, relates to just that. At the top, there is this physics of incoherence, and at the bottom, it's coherent. And then, you know, one has to really work to get the parameters.
At least for copper, it's one.
Yes. I'm sorry?
If that was correct from a complex material, it seems to me the band picture would fail badly for copper.
No, why would it fail badly for copper? The band picture still holds, except that you need to think about the quasi-particle weight as a function of band filling, which people you should...
I have a metal in which the Fermi level is towards the top of the band. It should be very, very incoherent.
It should be, except that I told you that the importance of this effect depends on the ionic charge Z. And so the amount of incoherence, or how small this Z is compared to that, they could be very similar. And then I'll get to that. It depends on parameters.
Okay. One more. What if I take a material band is half filled when I begin to move things close to where it's half filled?
Let me go to the next transparency and then let me come back to your question, because this is really not the whole story. So now so this is just the simple story, and now there is some intraband physics that we need to worry about. And so what we need to put on top of this is perhaps what you're asking about. There is some Z inside the band from intraband correlations, and close to half filling, that's going to be important. And so there is...
I'm wondering, near half filling, whether maybe the effect you're telling us about isn't so big.
Okay, let me tell you what I expect.
One was down low and another high, maybe right in the middle.
Let me tell you what I expect, and then I'll show you some numerical calculations. This is what I expect qualitatively, that Z as a function of N, in a model like the Hubbard model, which is this physics for this epsilon going large, you're going to get that it goes down and then it goes up again symmetrically. And of course, it can go down to zero if it's beyond the Mott insulator and so on. As this epsilon energy spacing goes down, you're going to get a behavior where this is asymmetric. And in fact, I claim it's asymmetric for any epsilon that's not infinity, okay? But the importance of this physics increases as this becomes more and more like that. And that depends on this atomic feature, which is the ionic charge in particular, and on presumably other things. But so there is two components to the Z. There is this basic factor, which has to do with what's left out in the Hubbard model, and then there is the intraband Z, which is the electron hole symmetric Z that we know from the Hubbard model. Okay, so the low energy physics of there is a low energy physics and high energy physics of these models because there is excited states. But the low energy physics is looking at the ground state of 0, 1, and 2 electrons, computing this S, which is the overlap of, so when I remove an electron here, I compute the overlap of what's left with that, and that gives me an S that's less than 1. And then from that, you get that the hopping processes, just in what would be the anti-adiabatic limit, where you project just to a ground state, you're going to get a hopping amplitude T. When you have a single electron, when you have two electrons, you get one of these overlap factors, you get T times S, and when you have three electrons, you get T times S squared, T2. And this is again oversimplified, but at least in this picture, T0 is bigger than T1, is bigger than T2, and that's related to the behavior of the quasi-particle wave. So the effective low energy Hamiltonian then is what we have been studying for a long time, which is basically a Hubbard model with correlated hopping or assisted hopping or whatever you want to call it. The T depends on the occupation of the sites such that it gives you, this operator will give you these different amplitudes depending on the occupation of the site. And a simplified version of this, and written in terms of hole operators rather than electron operators, looked like this. So there is a TH for holes, which would be the hopping here, for a single hole. And then there is a delta T, which is T1 minus T2, which tells you how much the hopping changes when we go from this situation to this situation. And that's what people call the Hubbard model with correlated hopping. Okay? Now, this model we get from the physics I told you before. So in particular, one thing I would like to mention is, for example, in relation with DMFT, there have been some studies with DMFT for Hubbard model with correlated hopping, where they start from a Hamiltonian like this. And then the problem when you do that is that the self-energy has a momentum dependence, because this, of course, has a momentum dependence. And then it's hard to do DMFT. Okay? And the point is, that's a wrong thing to do if you want to study correlated hopping with DMFT, because what you really should do is go back to the physics I was telling you about, which is, where is the correlated hopping coming from? It's coming from this Z renormalization. And then when you look at those models, there is no momentum dependence whatsoever. And so it is rigorously true that the self-energy in infinite dimensions is only frequency dependent. And from a little bit of numerical evidence and just conceptually, it looks likely that the self-energy in these models is not going to be very momentum dependent at all, that the physics is very local.
Jorge, would you say the TJ model, as written by some people, is correlated hopping because somehow they won't let you go unless the site's empty?
The TJ model, well, it's different correlated hopping than this. But yeah, you could call it that. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so let me then say what I mean by dynamic Hubbard model. So that's a static Hubbard model. By dynamic Hubbard models, I mean this physics, where schematically I write it here as a U that depends on some degree of freedom, and here there is a Hamiltonian for that degree of freedom. So the Hubbard U can take more than one value depending on the relative state of the two electrons in the orbital. And so, again, the fact that this is at least the sum of two Slater determinants rather than one, in one of them, presumably, you have a large Coulomb repulsion if the orbital is small, but a small single particle energy. In another one, you'll have a small Coulomb repulsion if the orbital is extended and a large single particle energy. As long as you have at least two of these states, you have this physics that I'm interested in. So there is a new energy scale which has to do with a single particle energy cost in occupying these alternative states. There is then a spectrum of more than one value for the U. And then there is this parameter that is the overlap of the W occupied when I destroy an electron, the singly occupied, which determines the quasi-particle weight and the physics. So let's look at some models, either with auxiliary boson degree of freedoms or purely electronic models. All right, so with an auxiliary boson degree of freedom, what we want to do is the following. We want to put at the site, for example, a harmonic oscillator such that it doesn't change its state when the site has zero or one electron, and it changes its state when I put two electrons. Or with a spin degree of freedom, it's down when there is no electron or one electron, and it flips to up when there is two electrons. So with harmonic oscillator, the way to do that is to write down a Hamiltonian where you couple the phonon coordinate to the doubly occupancy rather than to the single occupancy. And so the equilibrium position of this phonon is zero if there is zero or one electron, and the phonon shifts if there is two electrons. And so when you compute the spectral function for this Hamiltonian, of course, you find that if you create one electron in the empty site, the spectral function is a delta function, but the spectral function for creating a hole is this well-known spectral function for the harmonic oscillator, okay, for the small polaron. So in the small polaron problem, you would have this spectral function both for creating an electron and for creating a hole. In this model, you have it only when you create a hole, or when you create an electron in the singly occupied side. And you can do a lot of mathematics similar to the Holstein model, the small polaron regime, the generalized Lang-Virchow transformation, which really implements these concepts of the relation between the particle and the quasi-particle that I was telling you about. So when you do a Lang-Virchow transformation, you transform your operator C into a Drest operator where the phonon moves with the electron with this operator X, which is this exponential. In the usual Holstein model, there is no n here. So the dressing occurs independent of n. Here, this is 1 if n is 0, and is not 1 if n is 1. And so look what happens. When I take my Baer Hamiltonian, I replace these operators in terms of these Holstein or renormalized or whatever operators. I get, of course, a more complicated Hamiltonian. If I project this to the ground state of the bosons, the expectation value is e to the minus g squared over 2 times ni minus sigma, which is this s. Well, I'm sorry, I call this s. And then it's this expression, which is what we were discussing before. So it's 1 if there is no other occupation at the site, and it's s if there is occupation. So then the relation between particle and quasi-particle operator, you get it explicitly here with the incoherent part, which gives rise to the incoherent part of the spectral function coming from the excitations of the bosons. And of course, then this gives you a correlated hopping if you just keep this part of the operator and replace it in the kinetic energy, which is what I wrote down here. Okay, and this is very important, the fact that the correlated hopping comes from this more generalized model, because when you look at, for example, some rules, in order to satisfy some rules, you need to have this part of the spectrum. So it's a little simpler to study models with spin 1/2 degree of freedom, and as you can imagine, simple to write those down. This is one realization where we just have a spin 1/2 sigma x operator here and sigma z operator there. So for 0 and 1 electron at the site, this is 0, and so the Hamiltonian for the spin looks like this, and if g is large, the spin is going to be pointing down. When I put 2 electrons at the site, the Hamiltonian looks like this, and the spin is going to flip. And so all these quantities that we have defined, we can easily map into this model. The u in this model then fluctuates only between two values, u plus 2g the omega 0 and u minus 2g omega 0. The s is the overlap of this state with that state. And again, we can write a simple model that has the physics that we are talking about. And again, in this model, the conduction of a hole is complicated because when an electron hops from a W-occupied site to a singly occupied site, this background spin has to flip. And for the electron conduction, the background spin doesn't flip. Okay, so anyway, it's all the same physics, and you can then relate it to the atomic physics ideas that I discussed. So in this model, for example, the spin down, you can relate to the Hartree picture of the atom. The spin down corresponds to the simple orbital, and the spin up to the expanded orbital in the Hartree approximation. And then you can compute, just from atomic physics, the values of the u's in these two orbitals, and extract the different parameters that will go into the Hamiltonian. You can compute the s in the Hartree approximation and in the Hamiltonian, and so on. So,
just to understand, you're doing a calculation, a Hartree calculation with the 2 electrons, with 1 electron, and with 0 electron, and then you compute the difference, and how, that's how you infer your U1?
Okay, the U1 is the interaction of the 2 electrons when the orbital is a single electron orbital. So when I don't allow the spin degree of freedom to relax. So I put them there so they pay a lot of energy. That's 17 Z electron volts. Now, if I let the orbital relax in the Hartree way,
right,
it expands, and that mimics this spin flip in the Hamiltonian. And so it becomes that.
So those are Hartree calculations with and without relaxation, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Well, without relaxation, it's not Hartree. It's just nothing, right? It's just compute the Coulomb interaction, right, between 2 electrons in the same orbit.
You have to always do some Hartree calculation to get some orbital.
Yeah, well, again, I'm doing the simplest possible picture where for a single electron, I don't have any harder calculation. Okay, for more complicated atoms, yes, exactly. All right, so you can then imagine how this mapping goes. And again, as I already said many times, the importance or the magnitude of these parameters, G and so on, depends on the ionic charge. So I have done Monte Carlo simulations when I was a kid, and so I started doing some again, but I've forgotten how to do it. So anyway, these are very simple calculations. But so what happens in this model? You put in two holes in a filled band. This is what the word lines look like. So they are pretty straight when you start the simulation, and the holes are far apart. Then they pair, and they start wiggling around because effective mass is going down. And you look at the kinetic energy in this simulation as a function of Monte Carlo time. You see it's high before they pair, and then when they pair, it gets lowered. And the hole-hole distance is large, and then it collapses here. So this is just a qualitative picture. What's happening is the holes are heavy when they are unpaired, and they become lighter when they pair. Now, in the conventional Holstein model, which we can mimic with this spin Hamiltonians in this way, where we couple the spin to the single occupancy, what happens there is the opposite. You start with separate carriers, and if the interaction is attractive due to this, they will pair, but the line becomes straight because effective mass goes up rather than down. You look at the kinetic energy, and it goes up when the hole-hole distance goes down. So it's exactly the opposite physics that comes out of this model. This is a simple picture of just the difference between electrons and holes, and it's a little confusing because it's in the opposite. But these are holes. So when the holes pair, they become more mobile. This is an empty band with electrons. I start the simulation with two electrons in a straight line, where they split apart and they start wiggling around. So at the bottom of the band, the electrons are light and they don't want to pair. Anyway, so you can do, for example, calculations that tell you whether there is attraction and so on. And I'll talk more about where it comes from, but basically qualitative, it's coming from lowering of kinetic energy. But in some things you can get analytically, other things you cannot. In particular, the dependence on the frequency, on this omega, which is the excitation or the spacing of energy levels, that's not totally obvious how it will go, and it's non-monotonic in particular. So for example, large omega corresponds to the correlated hopping limit. And you can see, for example, that when you lower the frequency, it becomes a little better to get attraction. When you make it even lower, it becomes bad again. So here is as a function of frequency, and there is this non-monotonic behavior. Again, this compares the model in the anti-adiabatic limit, which is the dashed lines, with finite frequency, and you can see that these finite frequency effects really help to get you more attractive interaction. But to understand the attractive interaction, it's very helpful to look at the anti-adiabatic limit, and I'll get to that again in a second. If you look at the kinetic energy lowering, it goes the same way as the effective interaction. So the kinetic energy of the pair is less than the kinetic energy of two single particles when the interaction is attractive.
So these are Monte Carlo?
No, these are exact diagonalization. Yes. Anyway, let me skip some of this. So then this is a calculation of the optical absorption, and the point I want to make is what you get when the interaction becomes attractive in these models is that spectral weight goes down in frequency. So up here, the spectral weight was larger when the things have a large repulsion, so they are unpaired. When you lower the repulsion, the spectral weight is pushed down. And that's generically true in these models. In the conventional model, again, this exact diagonalization, exactly the opposite happens. When you pair, the effective mass goes up, spectral weight is transferred from low to high frequencies. And this is ratio of low frequency to high frequency optical spectral weight as a function of the effective interaction. And again, it's qualitatively different. You get more and more spectral weight as you get more attraction at low frequencies in the dynamic Hubbard model, and it's the other way around. In the conventional model, and I would claim in all models, of that type where pairing is driven by potential energy rather than kinetic energy. Now, the same thing that happens in the optical conductivity in the two-particle spectral function happens in the one-particle spectral function because they are really very closely tied. So in the dynamic Hubbard model, there is increased coherence or increased quasi-particle weight as you pair, as opposed to the conventional hosting model where you push single particle spectral weight up to high frequencies when you pair. Yeah, this is all exact diagonalization. And I'm sorry? Just a few sites. The physics doesn't change very much. It's very local. And in particular, this is an example of why I think it's very local. I mean, this is the ratio of effective masses and the ratio of quasi-particle weights. And as I said, it goes up in the dynamic Hubbard model, it goes down in the electron hole symmetric hosting model, but also the amount by which it changes is roughly the same for quasi-particle weight and effective mass, which tells you precisely that the self-energy is local. Okay? And that is something that one can argue qualitatively, but by looking at this exact organization, one sees that it's roughly the case. Okay, now suppose you don't like boson degree of freedom, so you want to just deal with electronic degree of freedom. How do you find this physics in a model with only electrons? Well, you need at least two electronic levels per site, okay? Now, again, you may say, well, everybody has studied two-band Hubbard models and so on, but I want to focus on this particular issue. Okay, so the thing is I want to allow the two electrons, when they go on the same site, to pay less of a Hubbard repulsion by going to the next orbital. So the energy here is going to be u prime plus 2 epsilon. And of course, in the extreme where u prime plus 2 epsilon is less than u, they are going to want to be here rather than here when there are two of them. And that's just the Hartree picture of the atom. And in some intermediate state, of course, there will be some linear combination. But the point is they have some room to move. So the Hamiltonian I'm going to be looking at has a u prime, a v, which is the repulsion between these two, and epsilon, which is the distance between these two, a t prime, which is a hybridization between these two, which you have to put in, otherwise you don't get any physics because you cannot mix the two levels. But I'm not putting in anything else like off-diagonal matrix elements of the Coulomb interaction. And then I'm taking a hopping between sides that generically you can take to be different, or I don't think the physics matters much to be the same where they hop between this and that, or between that and that. And that needs to be explored, but I don't think it changes the physics. So again, the physics that we qualitatively are thinking about is that when the single electron hops, it isn't doing any havoc to anything else. When I have the whole hop, which is this situation, when this guy moves from here, this one is going to relax to here, and so there is going to be some changes which will change the z and the effective mass. So it's the same physics. You may be very bored by now, but it's nice to see it in different contexts. So these are the bands that you get for no interaction. So we're talking about two bands. There's a lot of lines here because I'm doing different parameters. But again, the point is I'm doing two-band Hubbard model, but I'm not interested in the two bands. I'm just interested in the lower band. I'm just saying to understand the physics of a given band, I need to take into account these effects, the fact that the electron can go to the next orbital. So I'm going to be looking at exact diagonalization of a small system of four sites where I'm going to be putting electrons and just looking as a function of band filling what this band is doing with those. And so qualitatively, for example, you see things like this, that when you're close to the empty band, you have a large separation between states. And this would be the states in the lower band, of course, and so for a single electron, you just have a single particle state. Now, when you go to the full band, what you get is a collapse of the bandwidth, okay? And that is related to this, of course, effective mass reduction and quasi-particle weight reduction when the band becomes full. And you can see these effects quantitatively. For example, this is just, exact diagonalization, calculating quasi-particle weight as a function of band filling. And this is for a case where epsilon is large. I don't remember the number. I didn't write it down here. And so what you get is that for this particular case, so the quasi-particle weight as u increases goes down, it's lowest at half filling, and then it goes up again. Okay? But when you look at it, you'll find that that's not exactly one when epsilon is not infinity. And then if I take now smaller epsilons, this thing starts becoming asymmetric, okay? And it's still going down close to half filling, but then it doesn't go all the way up, all right?
And is V 0 here, or?
No, V is not 0. Okay. V is some value smaller than U. It's bigger than U prime and smaller than U, I don't remember. Okay, and the physics that's going to give us superconductivity or pairing in this model is this behavior where, and again, this is a very small system. It's not particularly easy to see, but it's the physics I'm talking about where when I go from having one hole to having two holes, the quasi-particle weight is going up rather than down. So this physics of the fact that at the top of the band things are more dressed, which fights against the physics that you're used to, which is this physics where you become more dressed as you go to the half-field band, okay? So, and then this you can see in all these different quantities, this quasi-particle weight, this is effective interaction, and this is effective hopping. And so in the regime of parameters, which corresponds to this line, where so the effective interaction becomes attractive as you are at the top of the band, and that's the same parameters where this quasi-particle weight does this weird behavior, and where the kinetic, where the hopping does this behavior that when the holes pair, they become lighter. I don't want to go through this. Okay, let me just say one thing. You can look at the kinetic energy and compare with what's happening to effective interaction. What you see, again, is that what you expect, that in the regime where the effective interaction is attractive, the kinetic energy is lowered when you pair. So again, pairing is driven by lowering of kinetic energy. And optical absorption, again, you see that when you have a pair of holes, the spectral weight is moving down in the regime of parameters where you have pairing. So this qualitative physics, of course, by construction is in this model also. So I want to now leave these models and go back to the low energy effective Hamiltonian, which is the sector of all these models where you neglect these high energy degrees of freedom, because there you can do a lot more. And we studied this model extensively starting in 1989. And so just from this model, then you have this physics of the correlated hopping. So the bandwidth expands with hole doping. The normal state effective mass decreases with hole doping. And the normal state coherence increases with hole doping because the quasi-particle weight is changing. So, in fact, this you don't get out of this Hamiltonian, but up to here you do. And I want to focus on that. So, qualitatively, this pairing that we saw in the exact diagonalization a while ago through kinetic energy lowering is simple to understand, of course. If we assume that the T2 is much less than the T1, so the hopping of a hole is much less than the hopping in this situation, then you can easily see that a single hole has an energy which is minus Z, where here Z is not quasi-particle weight, it's number of nearest neighbors, I'm sorry for the notation, times T2, and when they are paired, it's minus Z times T1 because you have these kinds of hoppings, and if T1 is bigger than T2, you can imagine that you will have a lower kinetic energy for the pair than for the single electron. And this is qualitative, but here you can do exact calculations. For example, you can solve exactly for two holes in the field band and get the wave function and get it all analytically and get the parameters where you get them to pair and so on. You're confused?
Can you explain, since it's important, can you explain again how this is for the model, for the low energy model?
That's right. That's right.
So you just have holes, pairs, and empty sites with different hoppings.
Yes.
Then what's the mechanism? So no U now, right?
No, there is a U. There is a U. Yeah, there is a U also. What's the mechanism for what?
For the pairing.
The fact that these hoppings are different.
Yes.
Okay. Gives you pairing. Now imagine the limiting case where T2 is equal to 0, okay?
Yes.
So if T2 is equal to 0 and I put two holes in my system at a distance more than one lattice spacing, they are not going to move, okay? So the energy of this state.
You have the T0 process, which can exchange.
No, no. T0, I'm drawing holes, okay? So if the holes want to hop from.
Oh, okay.
Then that's T2.
Okay.
This cannot happen. I don't have three holes.
Okay, I was looking at
All right. So, right. These are holes, not electrons. So the energy is rigorously zero here, okay? Now imagine I start with a state where I put the two holes, say, on nearest neighbor sides, okay? Then this guy can hop here with amplitude T1, forms a W upper right side. Then this guy can hop here, then this guy, and so they move like that. The energy of this is going to be minus T1 squared divided by U times the number of nearest neighbors.
Right.
So no matter how big U is, it's going to be negative, which is less than zero. Okay?
Right.
So that's the simplest example where you can see how you get pairing from this process. Okay, so you have a bound state. And then if T2 is not exactly zero, then of course this is not true. You can still write down the wave functions for this case and compare energy and get the criterion and so on.
Right. So I can make exactly the same argument for electrons if I set T0 equal to zero.
Yes, sure. But what I have told you all along, I hope, would convince you that the only realistic situation is, I'm going to get back to that actually, but at least from this physics I was telling you about, T2 is less than T0, but that's a very good point and it's important. Exactly. All right. So what drives pairing is delta T, which is T1 minus T2. Okay? So here is a first principles calculation, again, for very simple molecules, but honest quantum chemistry, where I don't assume anything, I just solve for the wave function. Okay? And I calculate these hoppings. And in fact, what happens is the following. As a function of r, of the distance between the ions, you find that the answer depends on the magnitude of the ionic charge, as we were discussing before. And what we're interested in for this mechanism is the situation where T2 is less than T1. That's what gives you pairing of holes. And you can see that, for example, when Z is 2, when the ionic charge is large, it doesn't happen ever. When the ionic charge becomes small, it happens. And the region where it happens is for small r, and then they cross over for larger r. Okay, so the favorable situation for getting this is densely packed, that means small r, and negatively charged ions, which means small z, small ionic charge. And I don't want you to look at this picture of copper and oxygen because we are not talking about that. Okay, but this is the... Now, these pictures I was telling you with the renormalization and so on is the same physics, but it did not take into account the fact that when I put two electrons in an orbital, the orbital expands, and so the overlap with a neighbor is going to increase. And that fights against the other effect I have been emphasizing, which is the fact that when the orbital shrinks, there is an overlap matrix element. So there's two competing effects, and the story is a little more complicated than I was telling you at the beginning. But the same physics is there when you do it in more detail. Okay, you can also think about these things as generalized Hubbard models, which is as coming from matrix elements of the Coulomb interaction with off-diagonal terms. And again, the question is, these are all different ways of saying the same things. The question is, how do you calculate this? And formally, you can say that this delta T is this matrix element, but that's really misleading because it doesn't take into account the renormalization of the orbital. So if you calculate it this way, you get the wrong answer. But anyway, you can think about these effects, the low energy physics I'm telling you about in terms of these generalized Hubbard models. And the other way to understand the attraction is the following. If I'm looking at this operator, the sign of this operator is going to change depending on the wave function. If I'm at the top of the band, the wave function changes from plus to minus when I go from a side to a nearest neighbor. And so this operator becomes negative, and the interaction is attractive. If I'm at the bottom of the band, it's a bonding state, the interaction is repulsive. So in terms of the usual BCS VKK prime interaction, it looks like this. And I'm sorry if you have heard this before, but it's important. So it depends on the kinetic energy because the delta T has the same operators as just the hopping. And it looks like this. So this interaction is going to be attractive when Ek is positive, and repulsive when Ek is negative. And Ek is measured from the center of the band. So when it's at Fermi level is at the top, this is attractive. When it's at the bottom, it's repulsive. So it's repulsive for electrons and attractive for holes. And the physics is not any different from what I told you before. It's just another way of looking at it. The other interesting thing that you get from this Hamiltonian is something very similar that you get in electron-phonon theory, which is superconductivity from repulsive interaction. And that is, very quickly, because of the following. The VKK prime has this dependence on Ek and Ek prime. And you can even have parameters where it never becomes negative. So if the delta T doesn't have to be big enough to cancel the U, even if the interaction is always positive, you can satisfy the BCS equation because the gap that you find has this energy dependence, kinetic energy dependence, where it changes sign. And so as it becomes negative and it multiplies a large positive repulsion, it satisfies the BCS equation. So it's just a qualitative way of explaining to you why, when we just solve the BCS equation numerically and we look at interactions when the interaction is always repulsive, you still get superconductivity. So it's a very powerful way to get superconductivity. All right, so qualitatively, and now we are moving closer to high TC materials, what this model tells you in any energy band, if you have a situation where this undressing parameter is large, this would be the top of the band where you have no holes, and then in the normal state you have dressed carriers that are heavy. These dressed holes are the top of the band. When you dope, they undress. And also when you pair, they undress, and the effective mass goes down, and the quasi-particle weight goes up in both cases.
What picture do you have of being at the top of the band in the sense of, with all the Coulomb interactions and everything on, I would think you would be near the center of the band in the materials.
Okay. In which materials? In the copper oxide?
Mm-hmm.
No. I haven't come. I will come to the copper oxide orbitals in a little while. But I am very definitely talking about the top of the band, not the middle of the band. I'm talking about, again, the general picture of a band, okay? Here and here. So it's different from what you have been thinking about. So this is just numerical calculations in BCS, TC versus number of holes. Effective mass, which comes from this Hopping renormalization, goes down as you dope. Of course, you know that that's what high TC materials roughly do as a function of doping. Again, only qualitatively, the Z, the quasi-particle weight in the high TC materials from photoemission is seen to increase when you cool, when you go superconducting, or just emerge from an incoherent background. And in the superconducting state, it increases as you add holes. So it increases with doping, it increases as you pair, and also in the normal state, people see that it increases, so it becomes a quasi-particle liquid when you are highly overdoped. So you have coherence coming out when you have more holes or when you pair the holes, which is what these models will tell you. And this is M star versus N from inverse mobility, which, of course, in this paper is interpreted as coming from anti-ferromagnetic correlations, which I'm sure is the favorite explanation of most of the people. But in this picture, it comes from this totally different physics. Yes?
But, I mean, one can be very concerned as to extract M star from transport measurement of the mobility, right?
Because?
Well, M star, you would extract from specific heat and cancels out. It's not clear at all. This is a good indication.
Okay, we can discuss that. I think there is evidence from more than one source in the cooperates that effective mass decreases when you dope, but we should discuss it. Just some other qualitative things about this model. The fact that pressure increases TC that you see in the oxides in this model naturally comes about because this delta T, which comes from an overlap of orbital increases as you apply pressure. But let me not go into that. The other thing that's important is the gap function has a slope of universal sign, which comes from this delta T. And so it looks generically like that. And so there is something that hasn't been really seen experimentally, but I think with enough resolution it might be seen, that there is a shift in the chemical potential between what would be the chemical potential in the normal state, mu, and the minimum in the quasi-particle excitation energy, which is shifted because of the slope of the gap function. And so that perhaps could be seen in photoemission as the sharpest peak occurring not at the mu of the normal state, but at the slightly shifted one. So this slope gives rise to a tunneling asymmetry, which we calculated back in 1989, which is certainly qualitative in agreement with what they see in essentially all the current tunneling experiments, that the peak is higher in the polarity where the sample is negative, which is what we calculate. But again, it's getting late, and I don't want to. So let me. Okay, I just want to tell you at least qualitatively the story with the optical sum rule, and I know it's pretty late, but let me tell it to you qualitatively. The M star changes in these models as you pair, because the delta T causes a change in the hopping amplitude. So in the Ferrell-Gilbert-Ingham sum rule, and you probably have heard this before, the right-hand side will change. That means there is going to be extra spectral weight in the delta function when you go superconducting. And so the sum rule, the low-energy sum rule, doesn't hold. These models I've been telling you about predict that, and in fact we predicted it back in 1982, that there would be this extra piece in the delta function, which you can get just from the low energy Hamiltonian by realizing that the kinetic energy will develop anomalous expectation values when you go superconducting, so you will get a bigger term on the right of this integral. So we predicted this back in 1992. From the low energy effective Hamiltonian, you cannot get this physics. Where is it coming from? But from the Hamiltonians that have the high energy degrees of freedom, you can, because the spectral weight at low frequencies comes from a change in optical absorption at these high energies related to the excited states of this boson degree of freedom, for example. Anyway, I just want to emphasize that this was a prediction. The first time this was measured was in 1999 for the C-axis transport, and in 2002 for the in-plane polarization. And again, I don't want to go into details because it's late, but there is this physics of sum rule violation and color change, meaning change in optical properties at high frequencies, that these models will predict because of the pairing through kinetic energy lowering. And quantitatively, they measure about the kinetic energy level of 1 millielectron volt, which is very roughly what we calculated way before the experiment. So which orbitals in the Coupe rates? All right. I'm talking about these orbitals, and I'm not talking about the orbitals you know and love, because I'm talking about the physics of a filled band. So I'm talking about p pi orbitals in the plane. And I'm saying that they are full in the undoped case, and they become doped with holes. And if you don't like that, well, then let's look at magnesium diboride. In magnesium diboride, you are not going to argue with me that there is planes, there is p orbitals in the planes, there is holes in those orbitals when magnesium diboride becomes superconducting, and everybody in the world agrees with that picture for magnesium diboride. And if you notice, both in magnesium diboride and in the cuprates, this small ionic Z is the case because we have negative ion, boron minus here, oxygen minus minus there. The fact that we have negative ions is very important. Okay, so let me sum up, because I don't want to get hung up in the cuprates. I'm saying there is a qualitative difference between electrons and holes in a band, in any band, very qualitative again, and the magnitude depends on various things. Holes are dressed at the top, undressed at the bottom. And when I start doping a band, I am increasing the density of holes, and so I am going from a highly dressed to an undressed situation. And what I'm saying is that both when you are in a situation where these effects are important, you are starting with a highly dressed system of a few holes, and either by hole doping or by hole pairing, you are increasing the local hole concentration, so you get this undressing physics that will cause them to pair and will cause these also effects in the normal state. And so let me just put down a conclusion. Transparency, I try to convince you that the Hubbard model doesn't describe energy bands that are more than half filled, that the new physics exists for more than half filled bands, and in particular that holes are different from electrons, that there is a new energy scale, epsilon, that is in between T and U that you cannot ignore if you're interested in this physics, that you can write down a generalization of Hubbard models, which I call dynamic Hubbard models, that allow the Hubbard U to take at least two different values, which will then represent this physics, that techniques like DMFT should be very useful because this is very local physics. There's a lot of interesting questions as far as how to represent this physics in models. Solving the models with DMFT or Monte Carlo, analytic, whatever. Of course, very important, how do we connect with any real material other than the hydrogen atom and physics, superconductivity, ferromagnetism perhaps, which I didn't talk about, and whatever. Thank you. Yes.
I'm very confused about your picture for cuprate. So in your picture, the undoped material is basically a completely filled band.
Which endoped?
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about electron doped superconductor, huh?
No.
Oh, undoped. Undoped.
Undoped.
Undoped. Let me try.
I don't understand why we are at the top of the band.
Okay. Let me try and see if I have this other transparency, just a second. But it's a different band than the one you're used to think about. So let me put up. Let me put up this transparency. So I don't know if this will make it any clearer. There's two bands. There is a band that comes from copper, oxygen, copper, which is half-filled and is a mod insulator for the undoped. And there is this band, which in the undoped case is totally full, okay? Now the question is, what is this band and what happens when you dope? What
the P sigma and
pi in the plane. What we are saying is that when you dope, you both close the Mott-Hubbard gap and you put the Fermi level here. And that what gives rise to superconductivity is these carriers. And that these carriers are the ones that...
What's the difference in energy between that field band and
Well, who are you asking? Band structure theorists have a lot of difficulty calculating band structure for copper oxide. Don't we know that? Now, if you guys can do a DMFT calculation that can tell us exactly where this band is.
Well, let's say I'm asking the electronic structure.
Electronic structure people will tell you that this band is further down. Okay?
Yeah,
that's what they will tell you. Now, why are you going to believe them in that and not in the fact that there is no Mott-Hubbard gap? It's a complicated material.
Okay, fine.
That's what I'm saying.
I just want to understand.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that they are wrong in that. What I'm being down here, it's very close.
But they would have that energy scale be what?
1 or 2 eV. I'm not sure exactly. Not more than that. No.
Not I don't think.
Matthias, do you know? Okay, magnesium diboride, we will agree that the Fermi level is where...
But how fit, so...
This unique case, the five bands will go to level.
Which, magnesium diboride? Well, okay.
I see. But so in the end of material, this band is completely dead, we have...
Exactly.
Half-field band, we have...
Antiferromagnetism, exactly. Exactly.
And then we doped holes, and in your view, they go to the top of that P5 band.
Exactly. Exactly. That's my point. And I want to emphasize at this point, I've been talking about for 15 years, magnesium diboride shows this, okay? So at least in that sense, it's exactly the picture we
I think you've found the right material there. Cuprate's your problem because there's NQR data, I think. And from the NQR data, they can measure the electric field gradients when they dope in the holes.
Okay.
My understanding of it is they have a very nice picture that comes from the dx squared minus y squared in sigma structure band. Mm-hmm. And if you put the holes in there, it'll create the field gradients that
Okay, I will look at the NQR. That's interesting. Let me just point out one other thing. In Magneto Dipole, they measure these two gaps, the sigma gap and the pi gap, well, which is what we calculate, except that we calculated this 10 years ago for the cuprates, okay? Exactly that in the situation of the two bands, that the holes are going to pair and are going to carry the electrons, superconducting, and so the electrons will have a gap that is about a third of what the holes have. And this graph is from our paper in 1991, and this is from last week. So, okay, fine. Cuprates are complicated.
One would have to incorporate electron-electron interaction on that oxygen pi band, right, to apply your mechanism?
We have, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There is a Hubbard U and there is a delta T in that oxygen band, and it's full.
So in your view, superconductivity in MgB2 has nothing to do with quantum.
Right.
Is there any isotope effect?
Yeah, in what, in this physics? Sure. Sure, there is an isotope effect that's a little smaller than what you expect from electron phonon, 0.27 or something. I can estimate the isotope effect in this model. Qualitative, it comes from the fact that the delta T is sensitive to ionic vibrations. And so just from 0-point fluctuations, it will increase if the mass of the ion becomes smaller. You need a very small electron phonon coupling to make that happen. So there's certainly no qualitative problem with isotope effect. But I don't know. I mean, sure, the cuprates, everybody has their own view. I just wanted to emphasize that this physics of holes being different from electrons in energy bands and having to extend the Hubbard model, I think, is independent of the cuprates, and it's something one should think about.
Could one start seeing some of this, in your opinion, in the difference between the electron dope? Now we get in more trouble, I guess. Electron dope cuprates.
No.
What? The electron dope ones aren't old.
Yeah, well, in my view, when you put electrons in the, and again, there is a simple picture that goes with it. When you put an electron, you induce a hole and transport evidence, which you probably didn't follow, but I follow very closely because it's important for this model. In 1994, 1995, very detailed transport experiments in the electron dope cuprate show that there is two-band transport and that the holes start to dominate the transport when they go superconducting, from the Maryland group, for example. So there is certainly a consistent story with electron dope materials.
What about another molecule?
Yes.
Another somewhat more complex system, but maybe it's a molecule where we have very good quantum chemistry populations to compare with this picture that you're telling us about, of what happens. It's different whether you imagine electron or hole.
Okay, like for example, what?
I need help from someone who knows the right.
Paco?
I have calculated, it's relatively easy to do. You take a quantum dot, then you can calculate this effect because in the limit of very many electrons, interactions are a weak effect. So they show up. The only thing probably Jorge won't like is that the sign of the delta T is not fixed in a quantum dot. It can be either way. But it's comparable to other corrections people have been studying in quantum dots due to interactions.
Now, in simple molecules, you certainly can calculate these things as I did in these very simple calculations. And of course, you could do it and you obviously are going to find that the hoppings are going to change when you change the number of electrons. Why shouldn't they? So the question is not really that. The question is, do they have the sign that I'm saying they have, and is it change as important as I'm saying it is? And again, I want to emphasize that at least qualitatively, I have no doubt that any calculation will tell you that these effects become larger as the ionic charge becomes smaller. And the fact that you see superconductivity in magnesium diborite, and let me just make a prediction, because the first prediction I saw, at least in recent times of superconductivity, was by Pickett that you would have 100 degree superconductivity in lithium, carbon, boron, right? So it's, something like that. So the idea is that you take magnesium diboride, you put lithium instead of magnesium. So lithium is lithium plus instead of lithium We have magnesium plus plus. So in the planes, instead of having boron minus, I have boron minus carbon zero. Okay? The band structure is very similar. And so you have, again, holes in a filled band. And Pickett calculates electron-phonon coupling, and he finds that it's going to be much larger in this situation. So he predicts a much larger TC. I predict zero TC because of this ionic charge business. Here we are replacing a negative ion by a neutral ion. You're not changing the band structure, but you're changing this ability of the orbital to change. And so the magnitude of the delta T is going to be much, much smaller. So this does give you criteria and definite expectations, which you can at least compare. So I make a pledge that if somebody finds 100 degrees superconductivity in this material, I will publicly denounce this theory as going against nature.
Any other questions? Then let's thank Jorge for his